Welcome to another edition of ACE's Patient Focused Update, the podcast for Americans for Safe Access. I'm Russ Belville, and joining us today, we have David Mangone, who's the Legislative Analyst and Counsel for Americans for Safe Access. David, welcome to the program.
Hey, Russ. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here today. There's so much going on the policy front that has an impact on patients out there in the 29 states that have enacted protections for the medical use of cannabis. Most particularly, we had the big news last week of the rescinding of not just the Cole memo, and that's gotten a lot of attention, but also the Ogden memo. And these memos had to do with the enforcement of federal laws against Schedule I controlled substances, namely marijuana or cannabis, in those states that have legalized for adult recreational use, the Cole memo, or for medical purposes, the Ogden memo. Can you tell us how the rescinding of these memos has affected the policies that protect medical cannabis patients and what you think about this action by the Sessions Department of Justice?
Well, sure. As you said, last week was pretty tumultuous in terms of the policy front dealing with cannabis, both recreational and medical. So the rescission of these memos, I think, has gotten a lot of coverage appropriately, but also there's been some inaccuracies in the coverage that's been displayed. These memos have never been binding law or really, you know, codified in any sense. They've been priorities of the Justice Department in terms of how federal prosecutors should approach cases and how the Department of Justice should best use its resources in prosecuting various crimes. So the real protections that exist right now come from the CJS medical marijuana amendment, known as Roebucker-Blumenhauer, and most recently introduced by Senator Patrick Leahy, that exists in the current budget, which actually prevents the Justice Department from spending any funds on prosecuting those who are implementing programs or prosecuting patients. So while these memos certainly provided guidance to help prosecutors determine how they were going to pursue cases, there was really no real legal teeth to them. But they certainly helped establish framework for a lot of states. A lot of states cite the priorities of the Cole memo in their state legislative responses to develop medical cannabis programs. So this is a significant blow, but there are still a layer of protections that remain for patients.
Now that one of the layers is the amendment you referred to, the CJS amendment. They're preventing the federal government from spending any taxpayer dollars to go after state compliant medical cannabis operations. But doesn't that expire soon, like within 10 or 11 days?
It does. It's set to expire without any action by Congress on January 19th. And I think before this rescission was announced, I think many advocates in this space were incredibly nervous about the future of it. I am still apprehensive about what's going to happen with this amendment. But when you look at the outpouring of support for this amendment and the backlash against Attorney General Sessions to rescind this memo from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle, you really see that this has become part of a conversation for lawmakers again. I think for a long time that this amendment has been sort of a cover for individuals who didn't want to take a direct vote on cannabis policy. But based on the reactions, I think that there's certainly going to be people who are going to fight for these protections, if not fight for an expanded federal cannabis policy.
The other consideration that we have moving forward, of course, would have to do with the actions that might be taken by particular U.S. attorneys. And I'm thinking in particular, we had these protections in place when the Kettle Falls 5 case took place, Eastern District of Washington, where they have medical cannabis, they have recreational cannabis, and they had this amendment protecting them from DOJ. Now, thankfully, they've had a lot of those charges vacated, dismissed, and so forth, not until after the senior of the family passed away, unfortunately. But could a rogue U.S. attorney go out on their own now and provide severe headaches and incarceration and raids in some of the medical cannabis states if this Roebucker Amendment doesn't get renewed?
Absolutely. You could see that. And you've seen sort of a split reaction among U.S. attorneys to this news of the rescission. You've had individuals like the U.S. attorney in Colorado basically say that their enforcement priorities are going to remain the same. They're not going to see a big change regardless of the rescission. And then you have other U.S. attorneys, Louisiana, for instance, who have said that this is really going to be a return to law and order and federal enforcement the way it was intended to be enforced. So I think you're going to have some of these U.S. attorneys who have been appointed by this administration really come out strong on this issue and make a name for themselves and try to get some high-profile cases. Now, that being said, in the states that have passed programs, most of these charges typically happen on a state level. That may change with potential repeal of the CJS amendment, but you typically see charges brought on a state level for state crime. So if a state still has a program, it's unlikely that these charges will proceed, but it's tough to predict what U.S. attorneys are going to do now that they have this additional leeway.
I recently saw a video, I think it was from today, actually, of President Trump speaking about the drug problem in America, and specifically he was speaking about opioids, saying, quote, "We've never seen it like this before," referring to the overdose deaths that now top some 60,000 a year. And given his prior praise of a brutal dictator like Duterte out there in the Philippines, who's treating drug crimes very harshly by, you know, having vigilante gangs and police killings and so forth, and his recent comments today, President Trump's comments today, saying that the countries that deal with drugs very harshly have less problems. Do you fear the climate is changing in Washington to go back to a 1980s style drug war assault?
I think that's certainly a valid concern. As I'm sure you know, on the campaign trail, President Trump had said that he was 100% behind states deciding their policies for cannabis, and he thought there was some real value to the medical use of it. Obviously, his rhetoric has shifted slightly, or actually significantly, but it's still too early, I think, to tell whether or not there's going to be this large-scale crackdown. It really seems as though the move by the Justice Department and Jeff Sessions occurred without consultation of the White House. Whether or not they approve this down the line, we'll have to see. But I hope that his change in rhetoric is referring to drugs that are actually a problem, the opioids, fentanyl, heroin, and not focusing on cannabis, which has been shown by many studies to be a safe and effective treatment for a lot of conditions.
Well, that's something I want to dig into a bit as well, because I know Americans for Safe Access has been involved with this campaign, End Pain, Not Lives, under the social media hashtag EPNL. And could you give us a little more on what the organization is doing with regards to opioids and cannabis and getting the education out there for the policymakers that need to know this?
The goal of End Pain, Not Lives is to really bring medical cannabis into the conversation as an effective tool for pain management. You have a number of states who have either legalized medical cannabis for chronic pain, severe pain, various spectrums of pain across, you know, a variety of conditions, either be cancer or muscular or neuropathic. And a lot of these states have realized, and there's research that shows that when cannabis is an option in these states, it really decreases the potential and number of opioid overdose deaths. So we're not necessarily saying that cannabis is going to be the solution for everyone who's in pain, but there are thousands of people who could be benefited by a less restrictive federal law, and then as well as less restrictive state laws. So it's about educating lawmakers, opening up conversations between doctors and patients, and really showing that this being medical cannabis can be an option to help lots of people.
David, I know as we are moving forward this year, 2018 is a midterm election year, and we have the prospect of medical cannabis being recognized in a few more states. I know Oklahoma's got it on the ballot, and we have the update that the governor has set it for the June primary ballot. How do you feel about Oklahoma's chances? I know Utah is looking at possibly an initiative. Are there any other states you might want to fill us in on?
Sure. First, with Oklahoma, I'm very excited about the potential to see what Oklahoma can do. You have sort of a gap in the middle of the country as to good cannabis laws, but you know Oklahoma does very slightly share a border with New Mexico and Colorado, who both have pretty robust medical cannabis programs. And it's not to say that the population in Oklahoma is any different. I think there's a lot of people who will be benefited there. I certainly don't think that Oklahoma is going to come out in support of any recreational market or an adult use market. But more and more state lawmakers are starting to see that this is something that can really help people, and that if systems are well regulated and well crafted, that there's no real reason to have some of the fears that some lawmakers have had in the past. As far as other states, you mentioned Utah. They're in the process of collecting signatures for the ballot initiative and are well on their way. They have, last time I talked with folks in Utah, over 80,000, and I believe they need 113,000 approximately. So they're charging along, and I think we're going to see some progress in Utah as well. Missouri is another state that's currently collecting signatures for ballot initiative for medical cannabis to appear on the 2018 November ballot. And in addition to the ballot initiatives, I think you have several states in the Southeast that are poised to make a move to improve their programs or to create programs. You have some very active lawmakers in South Carolina, in Tennessee, and as well as Kentucky, who might make some changes through their legislatures this year. So that would be very exciting to watch and keep track of.
David Mangone, the senior legislative analyst and counsel for Americans for Safe Access. You can learn more about the organization at safeaccessnow.org. Get involved with ASA in your state and at the federal level to help protect patients and spread the message of medical cannabis throughout the country and around the world. David, thanks so much for joining us today, and I hope you keep warm and get well there in Washington.
And Russ, before I let you go, I do want to remind all of your listeners, particularly those in the Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. area, that on January 29th and January 30th, our training arm, patient-focused certification, will be holding a training in Fulton, Maryland, to sort of tell dispensaries and cultivation facilities and patients how to respond and how to react in this post-coal world. So for more information on that, please check out our website at patientfocusedcertification.org. And it's going to be a great training where we're going to update a lot of information, tell people how to effectively respond and react to the most recent news and developments in the cannabis world.
You heard a Mid-Atlantic Seaboard, patientfocusedcertification.org. To learn more, safeaccessnow.org for the Americans for Safe Access website. David, thanks for being with us again, and again, stay warm.
All right, thanks, Russ.